Revelations of sexual harassment have been sweeping the nation in recent months. The discussion about workplace harassment was reignited in the wake of film producer Harvey Weinstein. Since then, allegations have come out against high-profile men across industries. Capitol Hill is no exception for inappropriate or abusive behavior and the difficulties there are in rooting it out. Over the past month, Kristen Nicholson has thought a lot about the dramatic power imbalance on Capitol Hill. She co-wrote a letter urging House and Senate leaders to be more aggressive in fighting sexual harassment that was signed by more than 1,500 former congressional staffers. She directs the Government Affairs Institute, and she has 20 years of service in Congress, most recently as chief of staff to Representative Jim Langevin, a Democrat from Rhode Island. Kristen, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, how big a problem is sexual harassment in Congress?
Well, I think we always, you know, those of us who have served on Capitol Hill always sense that it was a pretty big problem, as it is in many workplaces in America. But I think even we all, and I know I was surprised when we posted the open letter that we were seeking signatures from former congressional staff, to see just how quickly we got hundreds and hundreds of signatures in support of that letter, which I think indicates that the problem perhaps is even bigger than we realized originally.
Why don't we hear more about reports of sexual harassment in Congress?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's some complicated factors at work, particularly within, you know, Congress as a workplace and a culture that that create that dynamic, one of which is clearly you're dealing with extremely powerful public figures, and they have a lot of protections built in to, you know, to Congress as a workplace for them. It tends to be staffed by quite young, junior, often fairly vulnerable staffers who are ambitious. These jobs are incredibly competitive, and once you get one, you are, you know, likely to do anything you can to keep it and to continue moving up that chain. And so people are very wary of taking any risk that could cost them a job or cost them opportunities in the future. And I think there's been this sense, and rightly so, that it's not worth the risk because it's very unlikely that anyone's going to be held accountable for these bad actions or even that women will be believed or listened to. So I think that's one big reason. I think another huge reason is that you form these deep loyalties and allegiances when you work on Capitol Hill, both to your boss and to your office and the mission that kind of brought all of you there, and also to your colleagues. And there's an understanding that if, you know, one staff member names a name or brings up an allegation of some bad behavior that ends up costing the career of a member of Congress, that also means everyone that works for that member loses their job. And I think that's a very heavy burden for staffers to carry when they're making a decision like that, whether to come forward.
And these are small offices. They're, if you can kind of tell me a little bit here, but there's not a centralized human resources office. Each congressional office may have 6-10 people in it. So you're not seeing a place where people can go readily to an HR with to have a conversation or with a concern.
That's exactly right. It's very different from what most people would consider a typical, you know, business or corporate workplace. In Congress, each member has a huge amount of autonomy and leeway to hire who they want, to run their offices the way they want. And you're exactly right. We're talking about very small staff, especially on the House side. Senate have, you know, Senate offices have more staff, but still, there's no central HR. There's not this big, you know, layer or hierarchy of supervisors where you have barriers and people that you can go to for help in kind of mitigating some of these problems. And again, very little accountability. Members can pretty much run their offices the way that they choose, and they can hire and fire people at will. There are very few real workplace protections for staff in the House and Senate, and not a lot of oversight, not a lot of eyes on these offices. So when things are happening within, you know, the four walls of your tiny office, there's very few other people who would be aware of that. And yes, there's an office called the Office of Compliance, which most congressional staff had never heard of until a couple weeks ago when this all came to light. That is where you would go if you had a complaint about some sort of workplace violation, including discrimination or sexual harassment. But there is very little information made available about that office or how it works. And it is not, it's nothing like your typical HR department that you would go to in a larger workplace. So yeah, it can be very, very hard to even know what to do if you wanted to come forward.
Tell us more about this letter that you and Travis Moore, the former legislative director for former Congressman Henry Waxman of California, the two of you wrote to House and Senate leaders. What did it say, and what compelled you to write it?
Well, I actually had been thinking a lot about this issue when, you know, the Harvey Weinstein allegations and sort of dominoes started to fall after that. I assumed that lots of eyes would be turning to Congress pretty quickly. And I had been writing some thoughts on this. Travis and I worked on the Hill at the same time, but never knew each other. And he contacted me just via Twitter and said, hey, I've been reading a lot of your thoughts. I totally agree. And I'm working on this too. And he had actually drafted that letter after talking to some other former staffers, realizing what a big problem this was. And he asked if I wanted to help circulate it, and we thought maybe we could get 100 signatures. And so 4 days later, we had posted it on, you know, our Facebook and Twitter feeds, and it kind of just took off from there. And we had 1,527 signatures within 4 days. And what the letter asks for is pretty simple. And actually, some of these steps are already underway, which is great. But we requested that the sexual harassment prevention training that's available on Capitol Hill but has always been voluntary, we wanted that to be mandatory, not just for staff, but for members as well. Members are often left out of these kind of mandatory requirements. For example, they're not required to take the ethics training that staff is required to take. So we wanted to make sure that they were included in that. And then we asked for some reforms to this Office of Compliance that I referenced earlier, to the process by which a victim could come forward and have a claim adjudicated. Right now, that process has a lot of barriers. There's mandatory waiting periods, mandatory counseling, and periods for, you know, your legal options, mandatory mediation, and this process, all the while you're still working in the office where this misconduct took place, can take up to 180 days before you can move forward with a claim. And so there's just, we asked for some reforms that would make this process more supportive of victims and not so totally skewed towards protecting the offices and the you know, perpetrators, or if they happen to be members or staff.
Yesterday, the House approved a measure on a voice vote to require lawmakers and staff to take anti-harassment training that you were talking about. Before the vote, Speaker Paul Ryan said the current sexual harassment climate is unacceptable.
The fact that some people end up walking these halls are subjected to a threatening or hostile work environment when they came here to serve their country, to serve their ideals, that's wrong. That's a disgrace. We cannot and we will not tolerate that kind of behavior.
Are you convinced that Congress is taking this issue seriously?
Well, I'm certainly convinced that there is more awareness, at least publicly, than ever before. I'm convinced that a lot of members truly did not realize how bad it was and are now kind of moved to take some action. I think it's a great first step that both the House and the Senate have now quickly required this training. But, you know, it remains to be seen when these tougher issues have to be addressed, like how to reform the process and how to include more transparency and accountability, and whether or not to, you know, to really hold members to account. I think one issue is really does start with leadership. And I was glad to hear Speaker Ryan and Leader Pelosi speak so forcefully on this yesterday. But they do carry some burden here because, there have long been open secrets and gossip and whispers on the Hill about bad behavior among certain members or staff in certain offices. And I do really think it's incumbent on leadership when they hear these things to confront members and to make it very clear that there isn't going to be any tolerance for this kind of behavior. I think for too long on Capitol Hill, those kinds of secrets have just been kept quiet and people hoped they would be swept under the rug or the damage would be contained. And I think it's really important to start really confronting what people know that is happening now and making sure it's clear that can't continue.
Should Al Franken and John Conyers resign or somehow be forced to step down, or in the case of Roy Moore, bow out of his Senate campaign?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm disturbed by the allegations against all of them. I don't really consider it my role to to dictate whether or not particular members should resign. My focus really has been on trying to change processes and cultures that have allowed these kind of behaviors not only to happen, but have kept victims from coming forward for so long. And so what we're really trying to do is look to the future to protect the staffers that are serving there now and anyone who comes later. And I think, the issues about specific members are really up to them, their constituents, and their leadership to work out.
Kristen, thanks for joining us.
You're so welcome. It was a pleasure. Have a good day.
You too. Kristen Nicholson is the director of the Government Affairs Institute and served as chief of staff to Democratic Congressman Jim Langevin of Rhode Island from 2001 to 2017. She co-wrote a piece that appeared earlier this month in the Washington Post titled "Capitol Hill Has a Sexual Harassment Problem." You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. What would you like to see lawmakers do to address the sexual harassment problem? Do you see this as an issue that faces Capitol Hill? Join in, 800-642-1234. We'll return after a news update. A survey of congressional staffers by CQ Roll Call last year found that 40% of female respondents believe sexual harassment is a problem on Capitol Hill. One in six reported having personally been victimized. The House yesterday adopted a bipartisan resolution mandating that all members and their staffs participate in anti-harassment and anti-discrimination training. The Senate already adopted the resolution. The heavier lift, though, will be whether any new legislation overhauls the way sexual harassment claims are handled. Here to discuss the pressure on Capitol Hill to do something about this and the allegations that are out there is Bill Stewart. He's professor emeritus in the Department of Political Science at the University of Alabama. He's author of Alabama Politics in the 21st Century, which discusses Senate candidate Roy Moore at considerable length. Bill Stewart, welcome to the program.
Well, I'm delighted to participate in it.
Well, let's talk about your state's Senate race for a moment. A new poll from JMC Analytics shows Republican Roy Moore with a 48-43% lead over Democrat Doug Jones. A previous poll had Jones up by 5. What's going on there?
Well, according to the pollsters, it looks like that Republicans are getting behind, however reluctantly, former Chief Justice Moore, and Democrats who are in a distinct minority in the very red state of Alabama at the present time. Their numbers are not sufficient to elect, and Mr. Jones, unfortunately for his candidacy, he's not converting many Republicans to vote Democratic.
Why do you think that is?
Well, his positions are contrary to those that are reported in surveys of Republican voters here in Alabama. For example, Mr. Jones favors abortion, whereas most Alabamians, when responding to surveys, indicate that they don't support it. And even things like gay rights. And, of course, as we know, Mr. Moore, when he was Chief Justice during his second term, which he didn't complete, of course, he was actually kicked off the court or suspended because he had instructed local judges not to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. So we have a long way to go as far as our social attitudes are concerned, and I fear for Mr. Jones that the election returns on December the 12th will indicate that we have not gone very far.
So you see issues like abortion and gay rights can seal a vote regardless?
Yes. Mr. Jones has tried to get attention focused on bread and butter issues such as health care and the need for better schools and environmental protection, that sort of thing. But in Alabama, the social vote has been decisive for several decades now, and people are voting primarily on the basis of supposedly moral values rather than economic issues.
A report in Politico shows that since the primary election, Jones has ran 10,000 TV ads compared to Moore's 1,000. Jones is also outspending Moore by about 7-1. Does that line up with what you've observed?
Yes, it certainly does. I've seen many Jones ads, and I've seen very few Moore ads. I think that when the National Democratic Party concluded that following the accusations made against Moore, I think more money began to come to the Jones campaign, allowing him to advertise extensively.
So let's listen to a clip here from a recent Jones ad titled Voices, which praises conservative critics of Moore. Let's take a listen.
On Roy Moore's disturbing actions, Ivanka Trump says there's a special place in hell for people who prey on children. And I have no reason to doubt the victims' accounts. Jeff Sessions says, I have no reason to doubt these young women. And Richard Shelby says he will absolutely not vote for Roy Moore. Conservative Voices. Putting children and women over party. Doing what's right.
How is that ad registering in Alabama?
Apparently it's not registering. Senator Shelby, of course, is Alabama's senior senator, and as that ad indicated, he's already cast his absentee ballot, and he said he wrote in the name of a distinguished Republican conservative. He didn't indicate who that was, but for some reason the people are of the firm belief that Roy Moore is indeed a conservative like they are, and they discount the value of these testimonies of women allegedly harassed and worse by Mr. Moore. They have a distrust, as you know, of the mainstream media already, and so therefore they're disinclined to believe claims which they see reported in the mass media.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Bill Stewart. He's professor emeritus in the Department of Political Science at the University of Alabama. He's author of Alabama Politics in the 21st Century. It discusses in that book Senate candidate Roy Moore. And you can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see lawmakers do to address the sexual harassment problem? What do you make of Roy Moore's candidacy, of his campaign for Senate, in light of what has come out against him? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Moore also rolled out a spot this week, and we want to play it for the first time in a TV ad. He addresses the sexual misconduct allegations against him. Let's take a listen.
Five state campaigns, 40 years of honorable service. Roy Moore has been intensely scrutinized and not a hint of scandal. But 4 weeks before the election, false allegations, a scheme by liberal elites and the Republican establishment to protect their big government trough.
A scheme by liberal elites. It goes on to say he'll fight for conservative values. What's your read on this ad?
I think it plays right into what he thinks voters believe, that is, that the establishment does not want Roy Moore on the scene in Washington, and they're going all out to prevent his taking a Senate seat, which, as you know, was originally vacated by U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions. But as I say, Mr. Moore's supporters feel like that these accusations should have come out in one or more of the races that he's previously run here in Alabama.
President Trump is not expected to visit Alabama to campaign for more. Rather, the White House is reportedly considering flooding the state with robocalls, emails, and text messages. First of all, have you been the recipient of these robocalls, and why wouldn't Trump visit Alabama?
I personally have not been a recipient of robocalls in this race, either for Jones or Moore. I think President Trump has already visited Alabama. As you know, he supported Luther Strange, mm-hmm. who is certainly currently serving as a U.S. Senator from Alabama, but the people nominated Moore instead of Strange, so it would be embarrassing to the president, I would think, if he should pay another visit to the state and the candidate that he supported lost, even though, as you said at the outset, the polls at this point indicate that the candidate that he supports is ahead and will likely win the election on December the 12th.
Let's bring in a call now at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Becky, who joins us from Oshkosh. Hi, Becky.
Hi. I believe that whoever holds offices like Roy Moore or anybody in Congress has a good, they should have a good citizenship standing. When are we going to uphold them to that standing in this United States? If they've done bad things, they shouldn't even be running, and we shouldn't be electing them. That's my question. When are we going to uphold people to the standings they should be held up for serving that kind of office?
Bill Stewart, go ahead.
More people are going to have to participate. For example, in the upcoming election, it has been predicted that only about 15% of registered voters will actually go to the polls and vote. So until the percentage of adults who are eligible to vote actually do vote, I think we're going to continue to have these examples of bad conduct being rewarded rather than punished.
You say 15% maybe go to the polls there in Alabama. What do you see as the root cause of voter suppression in your state?
Well, I think that people are just apathetic, and they have had politicians promise them certain results if they were elected, and they have failed to deliver. And so people, I think, have the attitude, well, what's the use? I've voted X number of times, but there's been no real change. Mm. But in terms of what the caller mentioned, I couldn't agree more. And I think that the steps that you noted at the outset in terms of required orientation for members of Congress, and I think it also should be at the state level, that all state legislators would have training and education in terms of what was acceptable behavior and what is not acceptable.
Well, let's turn our, Becky, thank you, by the way, so much for calling in. Let's turn our attention now to Minnesota Senator Al Franken, returned to the Senate on Monday for the first time since being accused of sexual misconduct. Four women said he groped them, including one who said he forcibly kissed her. Here's what he had to say.
I just want to again say I am sorry. I know there are no magic words that I can say to regain your trust, and I know that's going to take time. I'm ready to start that process, and it starts with going back to work today.
So Franken said he's not going to resign. What has stood out to you about the case against him and his handling of the matter?
Well, I think he's handling it correctly. Obviously, we all wish these examples of gross misbehavior had not occurred. But I think having made a confession and saying that he is going to perform and behave in a much better way in the future, I think he should be given the chance to do that.
Do you think if Roy Moore issued a confession, issued an apology, would that change the dynamics for him in the race?
I think if he were going to, he should have done it along when the allegations first were made in the Washington Post story.
More and more,
I don't think it would make any difference now, particularly as his lead in the polls seems to be growing.
More and more House Democrats are calling on Michigan Congressman John Conyers to step down. The Detroit News on Tuesday detailed allegations from a woman who said Conyers showed aggressive sexual behavior toward her while she worked in his office. He's also accused of using taxpayer dollars to settle a sexual harassment claim. Do you see him resigning anytime soon?
No. Representative Conyers has been in Congress occupying a very safe seat for numerous terms, and I don't anticipate his resigning from the powerful position that he occupies in the U.S. House among his fellow African Americans, especially.
So this behavior on his part and these dollars to settle claim, that does not impede his work and what he does in the House.
It may impede his work, but what I'm saying is that I don't anticipate his resignation, and I don't anticipate the voters in his district next year turning him out, since he's been in Congress such a long time. But how his fellow congressmen will react toward him in the future on committees and subcommittees, I don't know, but it could be a real problem.
Let's bring in a quick call here. Steve in Milwaukee. Go ahead, Steve.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I think when we're with your guest here, one of the things that is troubling to me is, this may sound a little harsh, but we seem to have somewhat of an ignorant electorate. And we sit there, we have a lot of people who vote for presidential politics and Congress, who think, well, GG, I'm tired of this party, so now I'm going to switch and vote for the other party, these people who are kind of in the middle and such, and they expect great change. What we end up with, though, is, or I think the electorate is missing, is that we have a lot of ideologues. And so, for example, Republicans, even though they're not Obama, even though they weren't supporting Democratic policies, they were going to end up voting for policies that Republicans have always voted for, which is what we've seen, deregulation on a massive scale.
And Steve, we're going to have to cut you off here. So sorry here as we wrap up. Bill Stewart, final thoughts here and reflections on Steve in the last 20 seconds.
I think that we're going to see, unfortunately, more and more polarization of the parties. There is much less compromise and what we had, say, back during the administrations of President Eisenhower, President Kennedy, President Johnson, and on. But in recent years, our parties have grown further apart.
And we're going to leave it there. Bill Stewart, Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama, News is next. The Wisconsin Assembly will not release records related to complaints of sexual harassment or misconduct by lawmakers or staffers. The leaders in the assembly feel that making them public could prevent victims from coming forward in the future. By the way, no Wisconsin lawmakers have been publicly accused of sexual misconduct in the wake of allegations hitting from Hollywood to Capitol Hill. WPR state government reporter Laura White is here to bring us up to speed on how Wisconsin government is responding to sexual harassment. Laura, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, tell us about this meeting Assembly Speaker Robin Voss called this week about sexual harassment. What was the point of it?
Well, the meeting was mandatory for all staff in the state capitol, and it was on Tuesday morning. And it was something that the speaker said was intended to just make sure everybody was up to date on the state capitol's sexual harassment policies, that they knew who to go to if they experienced something that they wanted to report, and what the process would look like for investigating that and disciplining the person if they're found guilty.
Is sexual harassment a problem in the legislature, or at least a reported problem?
Well, what we heard from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and then the Democratic Minority Leader Gordon Hintz, who's fairly new in that job, he's only been in that job for about 2 months, said at this press conference on Tuesday that neither of them have been aware of recent incidents where people have come forward either to say a lawmaker harassed them as a staff member or a lawmaker harassed another lawmaker. So they said, you know, at least recently since they've been in charge, there haven't been any incidents.
And so they said no changes would be made to sexual harassment reporting and disciplinary policies. Can you give us some idea of what the policies look like, what they contain?
Right. So the way that the policies are now is that you can report, let's just go with a staffer, and it's fairly similar for a lawmaker. If a staffer, say, has an experience with their boss, who is a lawmaker, they can go to the HR representative for the state legislature. There is someone that the legislature hired about a year ago to handle human resources things, hiring and such. They can go to that person. They can also go to the leadership in the assembly, so Speaker Voss or Representative Hintz. Or if it's not their boss, the lawmaker that they had the experience with, they can go to their boss to report the problem. And then it goes through a series of conversations with HR where they talk to all parties involved. And then if an agreement is reached, or rather a decision is reached about fault in the case, then various disciplinary steps start happening.
Do we know how long this process takes?
We don't know how long the process takes, and that's something that a lot of people, or, you know, at least reporters and free speech advocates are kind of concerned about. We don't know a lot of specifics about this process because a lot of it isn't transparent, and that's something that assembly leaders really reaffirmed on Tuesday. They said, we don't want to release specific information about claims either that have happened in the past or are ongoing, because we want to protect the rights of victims in these cases.
So how do they know that this process, these policies are working, that they're doing enough?
Right. I mean, that's the real pushback that we got. I did a kind of an email interview, a back and forth a little bit on Tuesday with Bill Leaders, who's the president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. And he said the legislature's reluctance to release specific information makes it look like they're trying to cover up indications of misconduct. And he says that because they won't do that, and this is a direct quote from Leaders, he says the public should have zero confidence that the legislature is handling allegations properly. So that's really the primary pushback that lawmakers got on Tuesday, was that some people want this process to be a lot more transparent.
We're talking right now with WPR's state government reporter, Laurel White. She's bringing us up to speed on how Wisconsin government is responding in the wake of so many sexual harassment claims sweeping across the country. Of course, we've been talking this hour about Capitol Hill and allegations there and what the bipartisan resolution passed yesterday by the House means going forward at a federal level. And here on the state level, the Wisconsin Assembly says it will not not release records related to complaints of sexual harassment or misconduct by lawmakers or staffers, which does lead, Laurel, to this notion that there is a transparency issue here, perhaps. But is that a policy that seems to be pervasive in many staffing offices in government around the country? What do we know about how Wisconsin's policy stacks up elsewhere in the country?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I honestly can't speak to how Wisconsin compares to other states, but I can speak to how the state legislature compares to other state agencies. So say you are a staffer working for a lawmaker in the Capitol, and then there's somebody else who's working as a researcher for the DNR, for example. Assembly Speaker Voss said he wants those two individuals working in the legislature in an agency to be treated the same way if they were to experience sexual harassment and wanted to report that. And some of these pushes for transparency in the state legislature for releasing information about claims, the alleged harasser as well as the victim, that wouldn't happen, Speaker Voss says, if it was in a state department, because there are HR procedures that, you know, make that personnel file confidential, and that's something that's protected. And he said, you know, we want to create a workplace where people feel safe and where things are private, and we want legislative workers to be treated in the same way as other state workers. So that was a primary argument that he had to some of the pushback that happened on Tuesday that, again, you know, really was the primary pushback to lawmakers briefing reporters and the public about the policy as it stands right now.
So when we look back at 2014, when then Majority Leader Bill Cramer was found guilty of sexual harassing staff, how did this come out and what transpired there?
So this was a case that, you know, I wasn't around. I wasn't covering the state capitol in 2014, but this is something that came up, obviously, when lawmakers were talking about policies. And Speaker Voss said that this case, this 2014 case with Bill Cramer, was a testament to the fact that the policies work, that the legislature will be transparent if something like this were to happen today or tomorrow. So what happened in this case was Assembly Majority Leader Bill Cramer was accused of sexually harassing some legislative staff. After those allegations were made public, lawmakers stripped Cramer of his leadership position. He was, as I mentioned, the Assembly Majority Leader. So they stripped him of that leadership role and then asked him to resign his position in the legislature. Now, ultimately, Cramer did not resign and didn't step down. He actually served out the rest of his term in the state legislature, which was about a year, and lawmakers didn't move to officially eject him from the body. But they say that their transparency about the claims against him and their immediate action to strip him of his leadership role and ask him to resign is proof that they're straightforward, upfront, and transparent with the public about something like this when it does happen.
And with the Cramer situation, how did the public find out about this?
Well, I think, and again, I wasn't covering the state legislature in 2014, so I can't be terribly specific, but I know that it was a trip in 2014 that a staff member, a trip to D.C., that a staff member came forward and said that she had been sexually harassed by the majority leader. And so that became public in the same year. And then as that allegation became public, I think previous incidences also came to light. So I think it was a situation like some that we've seen today where something becomes public and then maybe there are other allegations that also come up from the past. But I think the primary focus that year was the 2014 allegations. And I'm honestly not sure how they became public. I don't know. I know that the victim was never publicly revealed. Mm. That wasn't something that happened.
And that's a concern here, is to keep victims, they say, to keep the victim privacy and also to keep more people willing to come forward knowing that there is this veil of being protected and not being disclosed as to who this person is or people are. Is there something to that side?
Well, that's what Representative Hintz, who's the Democratic minority leader, said in the press conference on Tuesday. He said that really their first priority is to protect the victims and people. He called them the people that could be most impacted by the release of information about the claims. And he said, you know, especially I think this is important when there's a lot of information about these claims already out there. I think he was alluding to a little bit about how sometimes chatter about these things maybe makes more things public than some people are comfortable with. But, you know, that really, according to Hintz and Voss, is their primary concern, is making sure that victims are protected. And Voss did also mention kind of as a I don't want to say secondary, but another concern that they wanted to think about was the rights of people who are accused who may have been wrongfully accused. He said it's important to keep things behind closed doors as this process is moving forward in case someone is wrongfully accused of sexually harassing a person in the Capitol.
So as we start to wrap up here, Laurel, is there any discussion of reviewing sexual harassment complaint policies in the Senate or other government agencies for that matter?
We haven't heard anything from the Senate. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald hasn't publicly weighed in on their policies at this point. I would expect that that's something that we're going to check in with him about pretty soon, obviously, as there's been a lot of attention on this in the state capitol and capitals around the country. We know that Governor Scott Walker had reached out to department heads of agencies recently to ask them to review their policies. So this is something that's certainly top of mind for state agencies in the state capitol, for folks all across Wisconsin right now. So we'll be keeping an eye on policy changes, but it sounds like, according to assembly leaders that we heard from on Tuesday, they don't have any plans to change their policy as of now. They say it's working quite well, despite some of that pushback that they got on Tuesday.
Laurel, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's state government reporter. You can follow her on Twitter at LKWhite. Earlier, we talked with University of Alabama political science professor emeritus Bill Stewart and Government Affairs Institute director Kristen Nicholson. We've been discussing sexual harassment and how the state and federal government are addressing it among their ranks, from a policy perspective and the latest allegations in Congress and what they mean. This hour was produced by Bill Martins. We had technical direction from executive producer Michelle Johnson. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.